Today's edition of the Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Life Change Tea.
Why go to getthetea.com? Because this important news could change your life. Socrates made a statement saying that all disease starts in the gut. Take care of your gut, and well, the rest speaks for itself. Life Change Tea is a wonderful way to aid in your digestion. Brew it, steep it, drink it, and feel it go to work. We at Life Change Tea have been around for years helping people just like you feel better. Lots of testimonials and lots of happy people. Log on to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Getthetea.com.
Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's Valentine's Day. Gentlemen, it's too late. You probably screwed up. I almost did, but I've got a lunch plan, so I win. And I bought the flowers earlier in the week, so I don't even have to stand in line today. I'm Derek Hunter. This is the Daily Caller podcast for the 14th day of February, 2020. Welcome to it. There are no debates and no town halls and no caucuses or primaries this weekend. Enjoy it. Enjoy the liberty. I'm sure some feces will hit the fan somewhere and screw up everything. But at least going into it, we have a weekend sort of free from planned politics. Anyway, it's the interview edition, the Friday interview edition, where we sit down with cool people and pick their brains. And this one is one I've been looking forward to for a while. We sit down, have a long talk with Wilfred Riley. He's the author of two great books, Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War, and Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. He's a professor at a historically black college out in Kentucky, Kentucky State University, and just a really cool guy. I really enjoyed the chat, and you're going to enjoy the chat too. It's a little over 50 minutes, so we talk about race, and we go into it in a way. Look, I don't toot my own horn. I just don't do that. I feel like a douchebag, and I get uncomfortable when I see people I know sort of shamelessly self-promoting themselves on social media. I kind of wish I had that gene where I could sit there and say, you should buy my book, and you should go to the whatever. I have a book. I think it's a great book. I think it's a really awesome book. You should buy my book, but I can't pimp it every 5 seconds. I have the Patreon, patreon.com/Derek Hunter Podcast. Every time I say it, I get a little, you know, there's just something weird about it. I don't understand why it is. And then you look at other people and they're just nonstop. You should just flat out give me money. I can't do that. But one thing I will say about myself that is a little bit self-congratulatory and patting on the back is I'm not afraid to talk about stuff. And particularly the one thing that conservatives and people on the right are terrified to talk about and do everything they possibly can to avoid it, and that's race. I'm not afraid of it. I don't care. I know I'm not a racist, so I don't really give a damn if somebody, some leftist goes, you're a racist, because I'd have to care what they think to care what they think, and I don't care what they think. There's a reason I rarely check my Twitter mentions, because I don't care. I know there's a whole bunch of bile in there, and I couldn't care less. I actually kind of enjoy knowing that it's in there, and when I do check it occasionally, I just kind of chuckle to myself going, hit a nerve. Who cares? Same goes for everything. I couldn't care less. I don't have a, I know it's sad. Here's a peek behind the curtain of Washington, D.C. And now I sound like I'm really sort of propping myself up, but I always thought this was funny and gross. The people who have Google alerts on their own names, it's like, really? You care so desperately about what other people are saying that you have an email alert sent to you every time somebody mentions you? I don't. I never have. I just honestly don't care. I don't even think about it. Actually, mostly I think that nobody's talking about me. But every once in a while, somebody points out, like yesterday, one of my tweets was on the, what show was it? It's not the Five. It's the Outnumbered thing. They quoted one of my tweets. And I got a bunch of emails and my phone rang. It was my buddy Brian, different Brian, who used to work at Fox. And he goes, hey, they just mentioned you and talked about your tweet on Outnumbered. You should run to the TV. And I said, I'm emptying the dishwasher. It's just, and it's like, oh, okay. But you know, it's neat. It's nice. you know, it doesn't, if it doesn't really translate to money, I don't really know why I didn't do it. You know, I don't look at it as an accomplishment. I'm not going to augment my resume and say, my tweet was mentioned on Fox News. I've been on Fox News a lot. I don't even have that on my resume because it's not really an accomplishment. Not that it's, you know, a bad thing, but I don't look at it as something I've accomplished. We sit down and we talk and we have an honest discussion. We get into some things that would probably make a lot of people, if they're having that conversation, uncomfortable. Professor Riley's a really cool guy. I interviewed him on the radio about a month ago, and he was coming to DC, and he shot me an email and said, hey, if you're around. And I said, yeah, let's do this thing. And we did it. I intended it to be about a half an hour. It ended up going 50 minutes. We probably could have gone another 50 minutes, but he had things to do. He also is announcing a project he's involved in called the 1776 Project that I think is wildly important. It is a center-right sort of black leader, black educator, black intellectual response to the 1619 Project by the New York Times, where they try and blame everything in this country on racism, starting with 1619, when the first enslaved Africans landed on the country. It's asinine, it's left-wing propaganda, and they're banding together to fight it, which is a good thing, which is an important thing. So you're going to get all that and more. But first, let's give a word to our sponsor, Life Change Tea. Life Change Tea. You go to lifechangetea.com, getthetea.com. Order some Life Change Tea. It will change your life. It'll give you more energy. It'll give you that pep in your step. It'll allow your body to absorb the nutrition in the food that you eat. What a novel idea. You got the caked on stuff inside of you that just kind of gets stuck on the way out. And I'm trying to be polite here because this is a family pod. But it's true. And Life Change Tea helps you out, takes it out, makes you regular. It's the tea that makes you go, as they say. That's why you need to use it as directed. One cup a day, brew up a gallon of it at once. You get like a month's supply with it. So you're sitting there and thinking, what am I doing with one cup of tea? No, no, no. If you drink it all at once, you're drinking a whole gallon at once, and you just ruined your weekend. Drink it as directed, and you will become regular and feel better and have more energy because you'll be able to absorb the nutrition in your food. Don't you need more energy? Don't you want more energy? Of course you do. Go to getthetea.com, order Life Change Tea at checkout, enter promo code Derek for special discounts on shipping and all that good stuff, and you'll thank me for it. Getthetea.com, promo code Derek. Don't forget to click apply. Okay, just quickly on the one controversy, non-troversy that's going on still, the pearl clutching over the Roger Stone sentencing recommendation. The attorney general had a sit-down interview with ABC News yesterday. He's going to testify before Congress at the end of next month because he's got a busy schedule and Congress has schedules, and that's just when it worked out. But Democrats are running around still talking about investigation. We might need impeachment. The president is interfering with the Justice Department. The president is the ultimate head of the Justice Department, so the president can't interfere. That's like saying Henry Ford was a real pain in the butt and he interfered with the operations of the Ford Motor Company. Well, he owned the Ford Motor Company. He ran the Ford Motor Company. Donald Trump doesn't own the country, but he is the president of the United States and constitutionally the head of the executive branch. The Justice Department falls in the executive branch. He has opinions on things. But according to everything and everybody involved, the decision to rescind and resubmit sentencing recommendations for Roger Stone was already underway before the president tweeted about it at all, because 7 to 9 years for lying to Congress is insane when murderers get less time. A first-time nonviolent offender. You would think that the left, sitting there calling for every drug dealer and everybody in prison to get out of prison right now because of an unjust society and all the garbage that they spew, would be a little bit outraged at the idea of a 67-year-old man essentially being told you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison because you sent some mean text messages that even the person who received them said he didn't think of them as a threat, and he misled Congress. Is Roger Stone guilty of the allegations against him, the charges against him? It sure seems like that. I didn't follow the trial, mostly because it's insignificant. I know that it has nothing to do with the election, and it has nothing to do with Russian interference. The Democrats want you to believe that it does, so they're trying to make Roger Stone a sacrificial lamb, just like they did to Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort broke the law, no doubt about it. He was convicted of that. But the laws that he broke years, in some cases decades, before he ever got involved in the Trump campaign. Yet they talk about Donald Trump's former campaign chairman is in prison for corruption. Had nothing to do with the campaign. They know it. They're hoping you don't. Roger Stone's convictions have nothing to do with the campaign. They know it. They're hoping you don't. He is a nonviolent first-time offender with a deaf wife who is now broke thanks to this prosecution. And it turns out the jury forewoman is a rabid lefty anti-Trumpist who had tweeted regularly about Mueller, about Trump, about Democrats, ran for office as a Democrat. So they've got a lot of explaining to do on the prosecutorial side as well. And if the judge had any ethics whatsoever, she would take a very long look at this conviction and at least consider the possibility of a mistrial and retrial. But in general, Roger Stone's probably going to do some time. He likely deserves to do some time, but he does not deserve to do almost a decade for things when rapists are out after 4 years on average, when people who physically assault people are out in like a year and a half. No, Roger Stone saying stuff that ain't true doesn't warrant that. He'll still be a convict. That's fine. You can label him that all you want. But to want him to die in prison shows the bloodlust that the Democratic Party has, that the liberal establishment has, for anyone remotely associated with Donald Trump. And it's a sickness. But the attorney general did say, and I think it's an important point. Some people are going to be mad about it. But the attorney general said it would be really nice if the president stopped tweeting about things related to the Justice Department. Kind of makes it difficult to do his job. He was already doing this, and now the president tweets about it, and it seems, and all the Democrats go, oh my goodness, oh my God, can you believe this? Donald Trump is directing the Justice Department. He is not. Donald Trump views Twitter as a sounding board, as an exhale, as a release. That's it. He shouldn't do that for everything, especially for certain things like the internal workings of his administration. It's profoundly unhelpful. If you have a problem with someone, you should pick up the phone and tell them, not tweet the world to it. If you don't like a decision that is made by your department, you should tell that department, not the world. But realistically, you should wait and see what the people you entrusted to run those departments are going to do before you sound off on it. It's kind of important. If you trust them to run the department, trust them to run the department. Tweeting about it does make the attorney general's job more difficult than it needs to be. Donald Trump's biggest wounds as president are all self-inflicted. They're all self-inflicted. If he could just exercise a teeny bit of discipline, attack the Democrats all you want, fine, go ahead. Criticize the media, fine. Don't fire down your own trench, at least until you know you've got something to fire about. That's what the attorney general is saying. That's what I've been saying. I think that's what a lot of people would say. And I think if Donald Trump could do that, he wouldn't be in a close reelection. By November, I think he would be up around 54, 55 points and easily win an electoral college landslide, winning 38 to 42 different states. That's just me. But the president's going to be the president. He got himself there. He knows he's going to do what he's going to do, and he'll get all the glory if he turns out to be right, and history will record it as such. So we'll just have to wait and see. I agree with Bill Barr on this one. Bill Barr is an honest man, and to kneecap him seems counterproductive to me. We've got a one-off sponsor here I want to give a shout-out to before we get to the interview. And again, you're going to like, and if you like it or if you don't like it, email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com. Tell me what you think of the interview. But first, look, top-tier performers in business and sports often attribute their success to their morning routines, whether it's waking up early, setting their goals for the day, exercise, meditation, whatever it is. But not everyone has the time to do it all. With Hydrant, you can jumpstart your mornings. Did you know that 75% of us are walking around everyday life chronically dehydrated? We're suffering needlessly from frequent headaches, energy slumps, and poor focus. It doesn't have to be this way. You want to kick the coffee habit because, A, it's gross, but you're worried about the energy levels throughout the day. So that's why you choke down that stuff. Well, to avoid morning sluggishness and the midday slump, you need to make sure you're hydrated. Hydrant created flavored electrolyte packets you mixed directly into your water to make hydrating your body easy and delicious. Each rapid hydration mix has four essential electrolytes your body needs: sodium, potassium, magnesium, and zinc. They help you hydrate quickly and stay hydrated all day. And Hydrant is backed by research. The formula was developed by Oxford scientists to provide perfectly balanced, efficient hydration. There's no synthetic colors or artificial sweeteners. The formula is vegan, if that matters to you, and you can choose between three different flavors or a variety pack. Hydrant starts at just $1 a packet for a 30-day supply, and you can save even more with a monthly subscription. And more importantly, for you, for listeners to the Daily Caller podcast, you get 25% off your first order when you go to drinkhydrant.com and enter promo code caller at checkout. That's drink, D-R-I-N-K, hydrant, hydrant.com. Drinkhydrant.com. Enter promo code caller for 25 off your first order. Drinkhydrant.com. Promo code caller, and you'll get that energy. Maybe you can kick that god-awful coffee habit and get rid of that horrible coffee breath, because coffee is just, it's the devil's sweat, whereas Hydrant is a tasty way to hydrate and get some energy in your day. Thanks to them. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to everybody. Thanks to Wilfred Riley for getting in touch when he was coming to town. I think you're going to enjoy this interview. And a lot of people would be uncomfortable conducting this interview or even being in the room while this interview was conducted. Thankfully, he and I had a nice rapport, and we went at it like a couple of guys, because we're just essentially a couple of guys, even though our skin tones happen to be different. Have a great weekend. Good luck on Valentine's Day, guys and ladies. You don't really have to do anything. No man ever got pissed because they didn't get flowers on Valentine's Day. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday. All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for Valentine's Day 2020. And if you don't have reservations yet, you're screwed. Sorry, pal. It's not your night. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. It's the Friday interview edition. As we always do, we bring somebody much smarter than we are, drag them into our life, and pick their brains for as long as we are allowed to, quite frankly. And this is no different. We've got an author now, and he's doing a whole lot of other things. But the book, Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About, is Professor Wilfred Riley. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Kentucky State. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's Kentucky State University. And thanks for having me here on Valentine's Day, baby.
That's right. All right, so let's get into this. First of all, happy Valentine's Day.
Well, to you too.
Yes, I know. Let me adjust.
All right, got the mic down here.
Far more people will hear this than see this, so we can make faces at each other too.
Fair enough.
And you can look wherever
blow
you
kisses.
Want. It's up to the director.
That's my last Valentine's Day joke.
There you go. It's got to be a fun Valentine's Day for you spending it in Washington, D.C.
Well, actually, my fiance at this point was going to come out here with me, and we had reservations and so on set up, and she went to the doctor to get a sleeping pill prescription and ended up breaking out, essentially, and staying home. So she is,
that's no good.
She's not happy, which is adding to the ambiance.
I mean, actually, so you're getting off easy because you don't have to be at home to deal with that.
Well, no, I've got to go woo the people that we're working with for some things here, and then go home and take her to dinner and so on in downtown Louisville. So I've got a packed couple of days of zipping around paying for things.
Well, you can't get out of it. And this is what I say, men, you're out of luck. It's too late. Ladies, you didn't have to do anything in the first place.
let's be honest. It's not a guy's holiday. No guy has ever said, you didn't get me anything for Valentine's Day, honey.
Well, this is, I mean, PG-13 rated show. So yeah, most of the major dinner reservation sort of things aren't really as relevant for men. Yeah, that's...
Not so much.
Guys are expected to do that, and men, you should go out and do that.
And we haven't been bought flowers in far too long, ladies. What's the deal? Come on. Come on. All right, so let's talk about Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. I also want to get into your first book, Hate Crime Hoax, which was a great book, and everything else that you're doing. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a conservative college professor. Most people think of that as a unicorn in the wild.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a little bit before the show. I actually usually describe myself as kind of center-right in that I'm, you know, a businessman by background. I have a bunch of guns. I mean, so that's generally how I vote. I don't really have passionate opinions about some of the boys kissing issues that seem to alienate a lot of the traditional right. But yeah, I'm a proud American. I'm definitely not in the Marxist camp. That can be an issue on a college campus. I will say, though, I think to some extent that's a bit of a stereotype. A few coastal cities, if you're talking about L.A., Portland, D.C., of course, you could count Chicago, where I'm from, that's on the coast of the Inland Seas, really define what people think of America as being. And you see this reflected in social media, too, Twitter and so on. And the secret is that very few people actually live there. I mean, the area that I live in, I live in the downtown of the capital city, Frankfort, in Kentucky. I live about 30 minutes from Central City, Louisville, about 40 minutes from Lexington, millions of people around. I mean, voting Republican or owning a gun is not considered bizarre at all in some of the trendiest bars in the world.
But the wokeness hasn't found its way to campus?
Well, I think that there are two elements of that. I do think that I love the huge cities. I mean, I love D.C. when I visit. I love Chicago, of course. I still go back many times a year. But it's not only the case that trends that survive begin there. We've got to keep this in mind as urban guys. It's also the case that trends that fail begin there. I sometimes read the men's fashion press just to laugh. And last year, the big fashion trend was supposed to be rompers for dudes.
Yeah,
button-down, frilly rompers.
Pour some out for that. They went out of business just yesterday.
Pour out a little liquor for something my dead homies would never wear. I mean, that's not a thing that happened. I think the same thing is true with a lot of woke nonsense. In general, I think if you go to the great southern colleges, Virginia or the Citadel, or the great black colleges, Kentucky State or Central or Morehouse, you're not going to see a lot of purple-haired people throwing firebombs.
I don't think you're going to see them, but it was never a matter of numbers. I don't think they were ever the majority or anywhere close to the majority. They are the loudest. Yes. They are by far the loudest, and anybody who feels aggrieved in the woke culture, first of all, that's what they aspire to. Secondly, once they achieve it or even think they can achieve it by proxy or by default or by manufacture, as your first book talks about, they get incredibly loud and attention. They get the attention of the administrators and they get the attention of the media. So it's disproportionate. And that's why I think you're right, definitely in raw numbers, the rest of the country outside of the coasts, they're 10 people. But when those 10 people start chanting and forming a drum circle, the media shows up, the administration cowers, and they start to get really weird things done.
Sometimes that happens. I will say again, at Kentucky State or at Virginia, which resisted some real significant pressures post-Charlottesville to change the entire curriculum. I mean, at a lot of the schools you interact with, Tennessee State, that are doing pretty well in that upper South, I mean, you've seen very effective resistance to that. I mean, people don't necessarily feel a need to throw out the traditional authors black and white and replace them with, you know, comic strips or whatever. So actually, without getting too conspiratorial, what you said, though, is pretty deep. I mean, that gets into the tradition, almost, of far left-wing thinking. I mean, there was a communist theorist, Antonin Gramsci, who essentially said that as Rids, as people that are dead serious on the hard left, we're never going to control the traditional roots of power. We're never going to control the military, which is an inherently conservative hierarchical organization. We're never going to control business, kind of my home tribe, which is about money. We're never going to control agriculture. We're never going to control sport. So how do we get what are seen as crazy feminist Marxist ideas into public? We control discourse. And there was very specifically a proposal about how to do this. Take over print media. Take over then-fledgling broadcast media. The hip medium at the time was radio. Take over the nonprofit organizations so that things people think are fair, nuanced, and neutral will in fact be controlled by the hard left, cough the SPLC. And to a great extent, that has been done. And that's why you see the narrative so easily spun. I mean, most people in coastal academia, most people in the charitable sector, most people in the media, 93%, according to Pew in 2004, believe a certain view of the world that's a tiny minority view among Americans in general. So that is an issue. But I think we need to recognize, one, a lot of people believe this stuff, which you and I both probably think is crazy nonsense. Mm. But two, that is not the majority. A great deal of the country is simply ignored. I mean, if you go into downtown Louisville, that's a city of 2 million people. I mean, the restaurants and so on are as good as they are in D.C., about on par with Chicago. It's just completely ignored that there's this large, red-leaning city there. I mean, there's never been a major movie filmed there that I can think of. So the most of the country, I don't think, this is point two, is moving toward this.
I hope not. But it you wouldn't know it, A, from watching the media, and B, from following academia. You're absolutely right about organizations that aren't inherently conservative by definition. Will, I forget what law that is, what rule that
oh,
is.
Oh, yeah, the
but
British it, one. Yeah.
But you've got things like the Pew Charitable Trust, the Carnegie Endowment for Peace or Arts or whatever. The Ford Foundation, none of these people were lefties and would ever consider themselves lefties who amassed this fortune, but their fortunes are now being used to fund things that would have them vomiting in their graves if they were still alive today and stuck in their coffins.
Yeah, that's the Gramsci virus. I mean, there are people in certain fields like communications, you're taught how to do this. You know, there are courses or seminars on how to take social justice ideology mainstream. Mm-hmm. I think that I tend to disagree
It's usurped its power in the Democratic Party. It doesn't get much more mainstream than that.
Well, there is one option, guys. But
I mean, if you got 40% of the country and the other party's got 40% of the country, I'd say you come a long way, baby, to steal a cigarette ad.
Well, it is still, though, there's a very specific trick involved in this. I mean, it's never a majority. It's how to selectively manipulate your minority into a position of power. Mm-hmm. I mean, so Bernie Sanders right now, first of all, I do, as someone who's voted Republican, I do get a kick out of the fact Bernie Sanders is probably going to be the Democratic nominee.
I know.
I mean, Bernie Sanders is a communist. Bernie Sanders is a guy who honeymooned in Moscow. I don't even dislike Bernie Sanders. He seems like he'd be a great guy to smoke a cigar with. He just,
or something else.
Yeah, or
just
yeah.
Saying.
Fair enough, yeah.
I'll give Bernie this. He's not lying to you. He really is genuinely sincere about his insanity, about his ridiculous beliefs, unlike many of the other people where I don't necessarily believe they're telling me what they would do if they had a chance to govern. Bernie, I believe, would try to do what he's saying.
Yeah, it's a somewhat terrifying prospect.
Right.
I mean, yeah, so, I mean, AOC and Ilhan Omar stumping for Bernie and so on. I mean, a lot of issues there. But, I mean, I think that even with Bernie Sanders, what you're seeing, though, is that conscious manipulation of the woke lane to gain power. Very specifically, other woke candidates have opted essentially not to run against Bernie. Warren's faltering, moving toward the mainstream. The issue for the Democrats is they've got about six candidates to horse race for a bit in that mainstream, quote-unquote, moderate lane. And they're serious people. I mean, Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg. They used to have my boy, Andrew Yang, the tech entrepreneur, but he dropped out.
I actually liked, he seemed sincere, too. Like he would be somebody I'd want to have a beer with. I still wouldn't want him to be president, but I believed him. He didn't seem to, nothing about him seemed poll tested. Nothing about him seemed tried, tested, made sure that it was palatable, watered down for a specific audience. I think he said exactly what he thought and believed. And like Joe Biden, I think he didn't know what he believed. He doesn't know what he believed. There was a lane, I thought, for Joe Biden in the middle that he never really tried to carve out, where he could have kind of had a sister soldier moment, remember, from Bill Clinton in 1992, where Joe Biden could have had a standing up to the radicals and saying, look, just because you disagree with us doesn't mean you're a racist. Stop calling everybody racist and everything horrible. This isn't a fundamentally racist country. This is a fundamentally good country. There are problems, but we are not this awful place that so many people on the left are telling. That, I think, would have differentiated him from everybody else. Instead, he just glommed onto the coattails of everybody else and drafted them in the, we need reparations, we need Medicare for all, we need this, we need that. And you couldn't tell the difference between him and anybody else running. And so he's irrelevant at that point. Then he's just an old white guy.
Yeah, the problem with Biden is actually pretty much exactly what you just said, which is that he turned his back on a pretty good record. I mean, Joe Biden wrote the 1994 crime bill. I mean, they're conservative Democrats I would consider voting for. Like, Biden, if he actually said the things he'd done. You know, I wrote one of the major crime bills in the history of the country. Worked with Newt Gingrich, worked with Bill Clinton.
But instead he had to apologize for that.
Yeah, that's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, coming from a black community, and not a, just a, plenty of rich black communities, by the way. Prince George's County is a couple miles from here. They're doing pretty well. But coming from a hood community, I was born on the south side of Chicago, grew up on the east side of Aurora. One of the things that you dramatically saw since the 1990s is the presence of police in the streets and the absence of gangbangers. I mean, the policies like stop and frisk that are contained in the 1994 crime bill, or that came out around that same time, Giuliani-style broken windows policing, saved tens of thousands of lives, possibly millions if you add in ancillary issues, car wreck, abortion, drug overdose. It's weird to see people now openly running from that bill. I mean, one of the things you've seen is that since 1994, crime's dropped by half. Mm. So if Biden had run on his actual record and said, look, crime dropped by half, you ungrateful kids are alive because of Uncle Joe. You know, I mean, if he had said that to a bunch of college-age protesters at a working-class university, that would have gone massively viral and the support would have been pretty strong. But he didn't. And I think part of that is just Joe Biden's very old.
I think he's a man out of time. I think he's a man who doesn't recognize the current state of politics. But look, there's enough people his age that voting in the Democratic primary for him to have gotten over the hill with them, especially in a field of seven or eight people who are viable. He just chose not to do it. He chose to embrace everything else they were doing. I don't want to talk all about 2020. God knows we talk about that enough on the show. I want to talk about your book, Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. First of all, when you sat down to write this, what gave you the inspiration? Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, the inspiration, when I wrote my first book, Hate Crime Hoax, people talked to me a lot about it. I've talked about it in airports, you know, bars, golf courses. I mean, a lot of people have come up to me. And one of the things that surprised me is that most of them didn't want to discuss specific cases. Yasmin Saweed or Jussie Smollett or something like that. What they kept talking about was chapter 2 of the book, where I break down the idea that there's a narrative underlying the crazy fact that people want to be victims in the first place. And I call this the continuing oppression narrative, the CON, although I didn't intend on an acronym when I first wrote that out. funny, though. But the second book basically breaks down the continuing oppression narrative, why there is this storyline in the USA that the country is a terrible, horrible, very bad place, and why you're not supposed to discuss each element of that. So the book basically discusses all of them. I mean, I go through chapter one, taboo fact one is the police aren't murdering black people. Taboo fact number two is there is no race war, and Barbecue Becky did nothing wrong, by the way.
Now, wait a second. I've got to stop you because you're a black guy and you teach at a historically black college. You're not supposed to exist. I've seen MSNBC. You don't exist. These are Bibles full of truth. Rachel Maddow tells me every day, and Chris Hayes, and nobody knows, you know, this community.
Nobody knows the black community like Rachel Maddow.
Or Chris Hayes, which is just Rachel Maddow with glasses. Or I don't know which one wears the glasses, but they're the same person, essentially. You are an anomaly. How does a guy growing up in Chicago and Aurora, Illinois, end up becoming center-right?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think the black community is a fairly conservative community. I mean,
it is, but they don't vote that way.
Yeah, they don't. Only about 10% of African Americans vote Republican, although it's close to 20% for black males. So, I mean, in fact, if you look at black males, about 20% vote GOP, 40-50% don't vote. So the idea that there's a massive over, that's actually an interesting point. Among black, reasonably successful men, 20% vote GOP, 50% don't vote. So when people say there's an overwhelming presence of kind of woke liberalism in the black community, that's simply not true. I mean, 30% is not an overwhelming presence in the first place. I think that there is an enormous amount of pressure from the white-led left. I forget what the Chinese term for that is, baizuo or something like that, but the self-hating white left, to convince black people that the best thing for us is communism or to recruit black people as allies. I don't find that most white leftists, and I don't want to broadly casting it here, but I don't find that most white leftists love African Americans. I don't find that they were soldiers or varsity athletes or church deacons or were in situations where there are a lot of just chill, regular black guys. I think the idea is instead black people would be good foot soldiers for radical ideas because we are the lumpen proletariat in the USA. And I don't think that's true. I think most black people want to be rich and successful, not to be leftist failures. But we've fallen victim, and this actually ties into the theme of the book again. Many African Americans have fallen victim to the idea that the USA is a permanently racist country. John McWhorter calls this the false narrative, or the 10 false facts. It's an idea somewhat similar to mine. But people believe many things, like there's mass incarceration due entirely to race that doesn't affect poor whites. That makes them radical in the black community. But these facts are wildly untrue if you check them out. So it's a point we both try to make.
You said that they've fallen victim to this mentality, but it's been foisted upon them by people in positions of authority, people in positions that are supposed to be of trust. Yeah. I grew up in Detroit. John Conyers, I grew up in the district that Rashida Tlaib currently represents. John Conyers represented Detroit since the earth cooled until he was forced to resign because of paying out sexual harassment settlements out of his office budget. His district, when he was first elected in the late 50s, early 60s, whenever it was certainly not what it was when he forced to resign.
Yeah.
It was a continued downward spiral pretty fast. I mean, I'm very familiar with his district, and you can see the shell of what was and see what is. Yet somehow, every 2 years, his constituents, who were essentially the victims or unwilling participants in this downward spiral, walked into the voting booth, pulled the curtain, and said, "There's John Conyers. He's my guy."
Yep.
Yeah. Fewer jobs, fewer businesses, more abandoned homes. There's John Conyers. There's my guy. How do you break that at this point? What must I view as a muscle reflex? Go into the voting booth. There's the D. There's the D. You know, there's the D.
I think that the only real way to break it is that the close to 70% majority among males in the black community who aren't radical leftists, and those white allies that want to see black people do well, have to start telling the truth. I mean, there are massive taboos around honest discussion of race, honest discussion of class. By the way, many of these issues in America, we need to break them, we need to ignore them. The way John Conyers did that, by the way, I'm very familiar with this style of politics in Chicago. I mean, one of our representatives was literally Jesse Jackson's son.
Mm-hmm.
The way you do that is to attribute the issues in your district specifically to racism, to them boys in Washington, to white people, the gray man, the man in the suit. I mean, there are a whole bunch of terms that would be used at a rally in a neighborhood where everybody kind of knows what's meant.
But 50 years, it worked. 50 years, I'm going to protect you from the evil suburbanites. You haven't. You did a shitty job because your district has continued to go to hell.
Sure.
So at some point, you've got to break that cycle of, I don't care. I'm going to try, like Donald Trump said in 2016, what the hell have you got to lose? At some point, there has to be that. Now, Republicans have to actually do the outreach. And the way to do that, I think, is to address what you address in Taboo, is taking on these things that are inconvenient lies in a lot of cases that are told by the left to perpetuate that mindset. Yep. That conservatives and Republicans kind of, when the issue of race comes up and you're talking to a Republican, it's like, okay, yeah, okay. And suddenly that's like, whatever you say, I'm going to totally, you're an African American, I'm going to totally defer to you. And I can't disagree with you. I'm just going to, whatever you say goes. That's not going to win anybody over, is it?
No, of course not. People hate submission and cowardice. This is something that's extraordinarily obvious. I mean, and I've had a lot of white athletes point this out, actually, just sparring back and forth and talking about things. If someone says, well, I'm a black man, and I'm confident in being a black man, and I think you're a racist, and you say, yes, I am, I'm sorry, sir, I'm such a terrible racist, that person is going to think you're not only a racist, but also a weakling and an idiot. In fact, if you say, no, you seem like a good guy, but I think you're confused about some things, you're my brother, I'm not a racist, then that conversation is going to go in a totally different direction. By the way, going back to the Conyers thing, this is so remarkable in that it's been allowed to succeed because the issues in black communities today, for example, illegitimacy, fatherlessness, are absolutely mirrored in working class white communities today.
Right.
Like, I teach 30 minutes from Appalachia. The same problems at the same rate have increased in black and poor white communities, and both groups to some extent have blamed the other for it, but that's been especially intense among blacks. And that the actual cause of this is the 1960s social revolution. I mean, welfare, changing sexual norms, like there are books about this by people like Heather McDonald. I mean, this is not much of a secret. It's just something that's not widely said in either of those communities, especially taking responsibility, not the black community. And it needs to be, of course. I mean, the reason Detroit is a bleep hole in many areas.
You can swear. It's internet.
Well, I don't know.
If you don't want to swear, you don't have to swear, but Yeah, fair enough.
Detroit is widely considered a shithole city in the Midwest. I'll be pretty open about this. I mean, Detroit has... I'm a Chicagoan, and I remember Detroit was always... First of all, Detroit was always a heavily black city, even when it was not just a set of ruins.
Right.
Detroit was a black and working-class ethnic white city forever. I remember the Bulls playing the Pistons going up to Detroit. A lot of things destroyed Detroit. One of them was the abandonment by the American auto industry. To be fair, the rich man isn't always perfect and honest either. We need to recognize that on the right. But the big element was the sort of social collapse we're talking about. I'd have to vet this figure, but figures I've seen for the fatherlessness rate among black Detroiters, 89%, 91%. That's how you wreck a community. It doesn't have anything to do with the people in the suburbs disliking John Conyers. But if you can exploit that idea of racism to ignore the problems you're responsible for, you gain a power base.
I understand the data, and I understand that the fastest way into poverty is to have a child out of wedlock. The fastest way out of poverty is to get married and then have children in that order. But if you go into it, you're somebody who's not particularly social conservative, but if you go into any neighborhood, doesn't matter, Appalachia, Detroit, Los Angeles, and you start preaching that, you're denounced as a Puritan. What's wrong with you, you Bible thumper? Get out of here. Who are you to judge me? I think judging is actually pretty good because, A, it doesn't involve the government. It's just societal pressure. And saying, having society say, this isn't good, is a good thing, is a good power to have. But how do you message that to people whose knee-jerk instinct is to say, screw you, pal, who are you to judge me?
Well, when I teach young men or advise fraternities, I just say, wear a condom or you'll ruin your life. I mean, it's really not all that hard to do that, not to do that without invoking Jesus. I mean, I think, first of all, there's nothing wrong with Jesus. I noted in the intro to the show that I'm not a Buddhist or a Hindu myself. I mean, most people have some level of Western spirituality in the USA, first of all. But I mean, I think that the baseline comment, I don't think you need religion to say things that are commonsensical.
But it's always retorted to as, because look, I'm not a particularly religious person either, but if I do say, problem is people are having kids out of wedlock, it's like, okay, churchy, calm down. It's kind of a knee-jerk reaction where we see things, there's no dimmer switch in society anymore. It's a toggle switch. It's on or off.
Well, I think this gets back, my basic point throughout this interview, which I'm really enjoying, I mean, you're making good points, but my basic point is, again, people need to start telling the truth. There is an incredible, I have never seen an Overton window, and I've traveled extensively in at least this hemisphere, I've never seen an Overton window, i.e. what you can talk about, as small as what I see in the Western upper middle class right now. I mean, the idea that it is racist to ask a girl at a bar, where are you from? Because she might be Asian. That's absurd. I mean, the idea that microaggressions are a thing that exists and it's the reason for an average SAT score 940 in the black community, same for Southern whites, by the way, that's absurd. This is all just nonsense. Cultural appropriation isn't a thing. White privilege mostly isn't a thing. People just need to sort of start using obvious facts to make points that are as clear as these. So if when I talk to young men, if someone said, one of the things I say is be careful about sex. I mean, if you're dating an SJW college girl, don't sleep with her if she is drunk, because a lot of things could happen. Don't date SJW college girls to some extent, but that's, you know, I mean, that's
to have a girl that showers and that eliminates them.
That's what to look for. Cleanliness, hair product. But no, I mean, like, jokes aside, soap. Because the last couple things were personal opinions. Soap, it's a good thing among people. But I mean, the last couple things were personal opinions. But if I'm talking to young men and someone says, well, do you have any advice for me with women? I would say obvious things like don't, you know, treat them well. Don't abuse them, pay for the first couple of dates, wear a condom. The fact that those things are mentioned to some extent in religious scripture doesn't mean that you are a religious man if you say them. If someone said, well, why should I wear a condom? I don't believe in God. I would say, well, because you don't want to have a baby. Yeah. And I'd pull up a picture of a baby on my phone, probably the one just covered in diarrhea, holding a liquor bottle they've just poured on the floor, that empty, you know, Hennessy Reserve. I mean, so just... That's it. That's the argument. The fact that religion has made some great points over the year doesn't mean that those points are invalid if you take away the religious element.
Right. Now, in your book, you do take on quite a bit of things. Chapter 5, Taboo Observation. Fact number 5, racism didn't cause the new problems of today. Yet we have a Democratic field that is driving in the rearview mirror. They're not looking out the windshield. They're looking in the rearview mirror because there is mileage to be made out of it. The idea that every candidate on the Democratic slate has embraced at least the concept of broaching the possibility of reparations.
That's insane.
Forgetting the logistics of how you'd figure out who's owed and what they're owed and whatever. But you have this situation where the Democratic Party, I like to describe them as they're running their Pope. They like to absolve people of their
guilt. Running for Pope.
Absolve people of their responsibility, which is appealing to a lot of people because if your life sucks, you don't want to think the guy in the mirror in the bathroom is at fault for that. There's some nebulous force out there working against me, even though there isn't. Again, talk a little bit about what you mean by this in Chapter 5 and how you can message against, because you know the messages, how you can message against that, counter it, almost sort of deprogram, like you kidnapped a kid from a cult and are trying to get him to...
Well, I do think that we out in kind of the business world, where, I mean, you're talking about the things at the collar, the environment here, younger staff, so on, we do kind of have to deprogram a lot of people that come out of the colleges. Mm-hmm. I mean, you do have to explain basic economics to a lot of people. You do have to explain taxes to a lot of people.
Civics.
Yeah. Just
basic civics sometimes.
Definitely. But even the basic element of why is 40% of my check gone? Well, you see, all those programs that you like. I've had this speech when I was on sales and trading floors at least 15 times with young guys. People who are in that trading environment often literally switch their party registration after they close their first deal. That's not a joke. It's just, well, okay, I just made $80,000. You know, that may be the only big deal I closed this year, but how much of that's going to be taken away? Mm. And if, you know, $80,000 over 1 week, I mean, you're going to answer $37,000. Mm-hmm. And that's going to have an impact on how people view some of these things. The rapper Cardi B was talking about this. Where the hell is my money gone?
That was a great video. And then she came out and endorsed Bernie Sanders. So you like wonder if there's a bunch of cognitive dissonance happening in there.
She'll find her way to the light. But I mean, in terms of the basic point, when you ask, what's this chapter about? Racism didn't cause the new problems of today. I mean, racism didn't cause the new problems of today. I mean, so first of all, one thing I want to say here that would be considered radical in academia, although just a common sense in everyday life, is that the idea of institutional racism is mostly bullshit. What generally happens when someone claims institutional or systemic racism is that they identify a difference between two groups. For example, SAT scores. Both groups are doing pretty well by global standards. There's no embarrassment here in the USA. But African Americans get about a 950, whites get about a 1080 to 1130. So the argument becomes, well, the SAT must be racist. Because we see that although both groups are doing fairly well by historical standards, the average used to be 1,000 for everyone, mostly whites taking the test, even though both groups are doing okay, whites are ahead by 100, 150 points, what could that be but racism? And I became interested a long time ago in, do blacks study as much for the test? Because I noticed that we tend to play sports a bit more, often the stars on the athletic teams. I know it's a busy social life. So I actually looked up some classic articles that have just been disappeared, sort of, a Fordham and Ogbu 1994. And no, we don't study as much for the test. We study about half as much. It accounts for the whole gap. So institutional racism is just pointing at anything and screaming, racism. Mm-hmm. If blacks did better on the test, you would bet that activists would say that despite our higher scores on the test, we're now discriminated against the affirmative action process. This has begun to come up with Asians. So to some extent, everything becomes racist. If someone doesn't notice you're black, well, that's the racism of avoidance. Can't you see that I'm a proud brother? But if someone does notice you're black, well, that's the racism of significance. Why do I have to represent every black person in the room and all this other BS? In reality, this type of mild residual racism has nothing to do with a lot of these issues. I mean, 3 points of evidence. One, a lot of these problems like crime or fatherlessness were much, much less serious when ethnic conflict was real. Mm-hmm. If you look at Detroit, there was a year, I think 1945, where groups of whites and blacks literally fought in the streets with bats for 3 days. Then both groups went home and took care of their kids. I mean, you don't want to make fun of it.
I'll see you tomorrow, Earl. I'm going to go.
Yeah, so you too, Leroy, Mike. But I mean, seriously, they beat the hell out of each other, but very few people died. And then they essentially went back to their lives. I mean, of course, arrests were made, as they should have been. But I mean, without ever defending the behavior of those white men or indeed those black men, illegitimacy simply, that year, I believe the black illegitimacy rate was 12%. In 1938, Walter Williams, it was 11%. So it makes no sense to say that if problem X was at 11% when we were literally beating each other with sticks, and now when we're talking about microaggressions, it's at 74% for us and 40% for quote unquote you guys, the problem is due to ethnic conflict. That doesn't make any sense. There's no evidence whatsoever of that. So that's point one. Point two would simply be that black immigrants don't seem to have most of these problems. The most educated group in America is Nigerians, West Indians, so...
That's one of the things that's very bizarre. If, as the left says, we're fundamentally racist, founded on racism, the 1619 Project, which you're countering, we'll touch on in a bit, but the idea that we're just fundamentally racist, nonstop, you can't get ahead, don't even try. First of all, it dehumanizes people. It saps their aspirations from them, which is robbing them of what makes us human and unique and individuals. But it's so radically not true. And it is done for nefarious purposes, for manipulative purposes, and it feeds into your first book. And we see this, the social justice warrior on the college campus. I have this theory, and you can tell me, because you've done much more. I wrote a chapter in my book about hate crime hoaxes. You wrote a book about it, so you're the authority. I believe that there is this mindset that is just beaten into kids throughout school that... We are this fundamentally racist, fundamentally horrible, oppressive thing. It's not beaten into them directly, but over time, little drip at a time, little drip at a time. So then they pick it up, and the people who it catches in are the ones who become the SJWs. They go to college, they get it even more so and more blatantly, and so they go out into the world and they say, there is this awful element out here that I have to find and fight. Yeah. And they look and they can't find it because it's not prevalent. Obviously, ists and phobes still exist, but they're so minute as to be almost irrelevant around here in the population. So then they say, well, I can't find it. So to draw attention to it, I'm going to create it. Mm-hmm. And you end up with these hate crime hoaxes where a church is spray painted, hey, fag, Trump, this, that, and the other thing, and swastikas. And the guy finds it, goes, oh my God, my church, I'm the organist here. And it turns out that the gay organist was the one who spray painted it. Am I on the right path here?
Yeah. I mean, I think this gets back to the basic issue of... there's very little correlation between actual racism in the population and these issues like fatherlessness among African Americans. I mean, point three there, there's a very similar rate of fatherlessness among poor whites. Mm-hmm. Those are the quote-unquote deplorables.
There's the only thing that's different is the percentage of the population if you look at each population individually. But in the general population of yourself, you're right. The numbers are very similar because people are people.
Among all whites, the fatherlessness rate is 37%. I mean, many of these issues, if they ever were, are not strictly black issues. I mean, they're American issues that we need to tackle as Americans. And I'm very, very willing to work with white friends, allies, countrymen to do that. I mean, this is stuff we all have to handle. Take care of your damn kids. But I mean, basically, what you're saying is correct. Like, the narrative of America as an evil, horrible place is largely BS. And, I mean, just a couple points. Racism's illegal in the USA. I mean, the USA obviously has a history of, in many cases, bloody racial violence.
No, it's illegal to discriminate if I'm an employer but if I'm a racist and I don't like you because you're black, I'm allowed to.
Point. Yeah. The moment you say anything or you fire anybody, I mean, the law begins to... So, very specifically, I mean, the USA, bloody racial history, but in 1954, we desegregated, or at least began the process of desegregation. I mean, that's Brown v. Board. Mm-hmm. So you literally can't have an intentionally segregated school, and that then, as you mentioned, spread into workplaces, restaurants. If you operate a barbecue joint by the road, you literally can't deny people service because they are blacks, whites, Hispanics. I mean, in 1964, we went from that to the Civil Rights Act, which makes racism civilly and in many cases criminally illegal throughout the workplace sector. That's the main effect. So you can't fire someone. Now, you can fire someone for almost any damn reason whatsoever. You can fire someone because you think they're an idiot, but you can't fire someone because you think they're a white idiot or a black idiot. So another bulwark there. I mean, since 1967, pro-minority affirmative action has been the law of the land. I mean, when I applied to law school, I was very openly told that I'd have a 15 or 20 point LSAT advantage over any white equal. I actually went to the University of Illinois because it was about the school my scores qualified to get me into. So I thought I'd do pretty well and I'd get good jobs. I didn't really see a reason to go to Yale and finish last in my class.
You didn't want to graduate with $250,000 in debt?
Yep, and a last place class ranking? No, I mean, I managed to pass it up. You know, and Big Ten people tend to have a very cynical view of the Ivy League. If you've ever seen one of them actually try to manage
a
business.
The University of Michigan, I didn't go there, but I grew up with that as my team, and that is my hometown sort of thing.
ILL, INI.
So then talk about where do we go from here? How do we get past this? Because there is... there is a very powerful force working against both of your books, or both of the theses, not personally against your book, but against both the theses in your books and the problems you outline and the solutions you propose, that is the entire political left, the progressives. It's not really Democrats, it's progressives. There's a big difference there, progressive Republicans too. But they have a lot of their power derived through manipulation. And the there are very few things that manipulate people more so than race. It's a very emotional appeal because there's nothing you can do about it. You know, it's like, hey, I'm a black guy. I didn't do anything. I'm just a black guy. Why do you hate me? And you're trying to hurt me because of the color of my skin. You see what happened at the University of Virginia. The video comes out where the girl is in the multicultural student center saying, white people, there are too many of you here, makes me uncomfortable, so just know your place and leave because you can go to the rest of the campus and we can't.
Wait, what?
Yeah, no, that's what she said. If you have the rest of the campus, this is the only safe space we have, basically, is what she said in that video. It's a very bizarre sort of thing to decide to announce to the world. But there is political mileage to be made. There's a primary where political mileage is to be made. I can't wait till we get to South Carolina. I can only imagine what they're going to try to do to appeal to 22% of the Democratic primary voters who are going to be African American. So then what do we do? Because we're moving away from what my whole life I was told was the ideal, a colorblind society where I judge you based on whether or not you're an asshole.
Yep.
And that's it. I don't care what color your skin is. Now I have to celebrate the color of your skin and take slings and arrows because of the color of mine. And you've got college campuses where there's segregation coming back. It's back in style. The same people are just changing tactics, but it's going for the same goal. The progressives are going for the same goal. They just changed tactics. What do we do as a society? Because there are a lot of people who are out there going, I'm afraid to say anything. I'm afraid to do anything. But they recognize it. They see it. And then they're kind of frozen because they are. I'm not afraid to talk about anything. I couldn't care less. But a lot of people are. So how do we as a society approach this?
I think people have to overcome their fear and bravely say things that are true. And this, by the way, the last chapter of this book, Taboo, is criticizing the alt-right, which has no useful suggestions to offer. I think the alt-right is an example of what happens when people don't bravely approach issues like this as citizens. I think that setting up a bunch of social media where your avatar is a talking toad and giving yourself a name like Julius Cicero III or Sex Pepe 12.
Come on, and that's a chick magnet. Are you telling me that guy's getting laid every night?
That guy's a winner. He's a beast. Star quarterback. But I mean, no, like the... But and I actually don't want to make fun of guys who feel isolated. I mean, if you're some working class white kid who goes to a very diverse school who gets teased because of moderate conservative views, like, look, I get it. That's not cool. But I mean, the backlash of posting We Was Kangs memes while identified as an amphibian isn't going to do anything. People need to learn basic skills, learn to defend yourself, learn a trade that will allow you to make money, and from that stable position, tell the truth. If someone says, you're a racist, the default backlash, if you're not a racist, should be, no, you're an idiot. Mm. It shouldn't be trying to explain desperately that you dated a black girl in eighth grade. It should just be saying, no, I'm not a racist because I don't think blacks or Asians are inferior to whites. We fought each other for a couple thousand years, mostly equally. I like you fine. Not a bigot. You're a fool. That should be pretty much the response. And I can't think of anything other than people saying that that'll help.
Can I at least say everybody says, well, somebody says you're a racist and you said, oh, you pulled the I have black friends defense. Like, the I have black friends defense seems like a pretty good defense to the charge of being a racist because a racist wouldn't have black friends, right? Am I wrong?
Well, there are two levels to that.
I hate black people, but my best friend is black.
So. Well, there are two levels to that. I mean, actually, that's a good question. So, first of all, the reason I said that I wouldn't answer that way is that if someone says you're a racist and you're not a racist in an empirically provable way, like you don't hate black people and you can show that, you shouldn't even bother to say, well, no, I once kissed a black girl. You should just say, no, I'm not. Do you have any defense of your argument other than default claiming that I'm a racist? Would you say that any white guy with a tie on in my position is a racist? So, as to your question, though, I mean, there's an element of truth to that. Like, I was talking about interracial dating once, and my partner is Creole. It's different from Cajun. She'd prefer to be called Creole. Creole and Indian, although she looks pretty Caucasian. But I was in a group where someone was saying, well, the fact that you're in an interracial relationship doesn't mean that you're not a racist. And I actually raised my hand. I was like, well, I'm a black guy, and my partner is, you know, Indian, white, and from Louisiana, or whatever. I mean, going into that background.
Yeah.
She's actually from Southern Illinois by background, but I went to the Creole thing. Anyway, but I mean, so you're saying that if I regularly sleep with someone who's Native American Indian, I'm still a racist? And the guy said yes.
Are you doing it out of spite or something?
No, but the guy said yes. And I was like, well, I do pay for most of our dates. We go out. We travel around. I like her. Me and my fiance. She's white and Indian. Do you have a, am I a racist? And he was like, yes, you can definitely be a racist and regularly have passionate sex with someone of another race. And it was just, it struck me as absurd in the sense that a racist is someone who hates all or most members of another race. What these people try to do in general is redefine racism.
Right.
So racism is redefined as any support for any system that produces, quote unquote, inequalities, or it's redefined as not being perfect on every issue as defined by communists. So that's how they say this. But again, the way to fight back is to say, pull up a dictionary and say, no, this is the definition of racism. I'm not a racist. You're an idiot.
But again, it is the default position. I just find it better to, A, first of all, if you're looking for who the problem, why you have problems in your life, find a mirror, first and foremost. There's no big grand conspiracy against anybody. Mm-hmm. Secondly, if somebody starts with the you're a racist thing, and it doesn't matter, I've been called racist more by white people than anybody else.
Oh, yeah, that's
white
constant.
Liberals in college.
Me too.
I'm just done with them. Like, if that's where you go, if you've got a you're a racist chambered, you don't have anything else. You know, you're not that interesting to talk to, and it's not worth it. Life is too short. But going forward, tell us about, because you not only have two great books, Hate Crime Hoax and Taboo, you have the 1776 Project, the New York Times to much ballyhoo, mostly by itself, came out with the 1619 Project, which redefined the founding of America back to 1619, when the first enslaved Africans, 20 of them, landed in Virginia. They made a big hullabaloo about it. It's a big section in the newspaper. Okay. They have an ongoing website. They have a podcast. It is nonstop churning. But academics have found many, many flaws with this. Massive flaws. And well-respected academics. The New York Times says, thank you for your interest. We're not going to address your problems. We don't agree with your conclusions. They'd much rather have the flawed history with their preferred narrative out there than the actual history that doesn't necessarily dovetail with things they'd already ordered at the printers. There does need to be a counter to that, and it's coming from you being launched today.
Well, yeah, so the counter that you're referring to is the 1776 Project. Mm-hmm. And that's not being launched just by me. The founder of that is Bob Woodson, who's kind of an emeritus figure when it comes to taking sort of a pro-American, pro-capitalist approach into black communities. And there's a laundry list of very accomplished people involved. I mean, in addition to myself, obviously, you've got Glenn Lowry, the legendary economist, Clarence Page, the columnist.
Clarence Page is a guy of the left. He's on board with this?
Yeah, it's center. I mean, he thinks, like, along my lines of when I jokingly say I'm a businessman with the gun, that's why I lean right. I think Clarence Page would say the same sort of thing, that something like taking care of your kids isn't a controversial revolutionary principle invented by the white man.
But now you're denounced as hate single moms? Why do you think a boy doesn't need a man in his life? He just needs a strong mother. But this to get back to the issue at hand, you've got a long the group of people with this project that they're all launching today is you have a tough road to hoe. The 1776 Project, just in general, can you tell people, by the time they likely read this, it'll be up before it's officially launched, but people will start to digest it later on in the day. Where can people learn more about it?
Yeah, I mean, within the next couple of days, if you Google 1776 Project, you should see most of the information about it, website going live, I mean, supporters and backers, let's say, on board. The actual launch of the 1776 Project is taking place today at the National Press Club in D.C. I mean, that's going to be from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. And essentially, this is sort of a nonpartisan, but really center-right and inclination, black-led response to the 1619 Project. And there are a couple elements that I'd identify there.
Why would you say the 1619 Project is wrong? Or would you say is most thing?
Historically, a lot of what the 1619 Project claims, and our focus goes beyond slavery to what, you know, black men and black people of all sexes and backgrounds and whites as well and so on should do. I mean, we have a vision for America rather than just a response to an opponent. But in terms of why the 1619 Project is wrong, a lot of it's just factually an error. I mean, one of the best known essays is called something like America Wasn't a Democracy Until Black People Made It One, and argues that the reason that the USA broke away from Great Britain during the Revolutionary War was that we wanted to preserve slavery. And there's very, very little evidence of any of that. I believe it's John Wood, the eminent historian, our best-known Revolutionary War historian, has torn that apart. I mean, he points out that that requires ignoring the Boston Massacre. I mean, that requires ignoring taxation without representation, the Intolerable Acts, literal fights in the streets between British soldiers and young Americans, the Boston Tea Party. I mean, it's completely ahistorical. I mean, most of those young Bravos and the Boston Tea Party, a large majority didn't own slaves. Perhaps their father did in some cases. Some, as I recall the story, were actual Indians. The rest were painted up to look like Native Americans. I mean, the goal of that was not preserving chattel slavery. Right. So, I mean, there are a number of things like that. Just one very obvious one without getting too wonky, because that the first is a bit esoteric. But the 1619 Project presents American slavery in isolation. So there's no discussion of the anti-slavery movement that existed at the same time, which led to the Civil War. We don't have slaves today. So obviously, at least as many whites and blacks of goodwill opposed slavery as supported it. The North is larger than the South. That's ignored. But I mean, other slave trades around the world are ignored. I mean, the Barbary slave trade, which sold whites, largely Europeans, to black and Moorish masters for hundreds of years, 1600 to 1830 or so, is not discussed by the Project. The rest of the Atlantic slave trade conducted into Latin America, people all races on all sides, that's not discussed. You might understand why someone wants to focus on the evil of their own society, but at the same time, you can say it doesn't make logical sense to say slavery made America unique without addressing the fact that all other societies had slavery and none are America.
I might understand why somebody would want to address the evils in their own society if it weren't backed up with the two punch after the one punch of that, of the manipulation behind it. And that's where I lose it. I have no problem. Nobody's perfect. Everybody takes a bath because they sink in water. Nobody walks on it. And to pretend otherwise is folly. But the New York Times seems to, they had an agenda and they found a way to fulfill it rather than going where the facts took them with the 1619 Project. And the 1776 Project hopefully will get as much attention, if not more, to go out there and correct the record. Last question for you, Professor.
All right.
As people close Taboo, and this will be linked in the video and linked in the post at the Daily Caller, Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. As somebody closes page 224, goes to bed at night, what do you want them to drift off thinking of? What do you want them to stick up in the morning? What's the stick to the ribs moment in this book that you want them to take with them long after they've read it?
Probably the most prevalent narrative of America, especially on the political left, is false. I mean, I go through all the things you're not supposed to discuss in this book. Are the police murdering black people? No. Is there a race war coming? No. 85% of white murder victims, an astonishing 94% of black murder victims killed by, quote unquote, their own people. Person most likely to kill you is your ex-wife or your current husband. Are gaps between groups?
Don't get divorced and don't ever get married.
It's a problem. It's a tough one. I guess it's a little different for men and women.
Yeah.
Like, women shouldn't get married, but men shouldn't get divorced.
Yeah,
so it's hard to know how to deal with that.
In or you're out.
But yeah, I mean, anyone can be racist. I look at the standard dictionary and encyclopedia definitions of racism as opposed to ones made up in some sophomore seminar on feminist debate. I look at white privilege. You can at least argue that exists, that there are situations where being white would be an advantage. But social class, sex, being born in a city rather than a rural area, height, a dozen things have much more impact. So I take that concept apart. The idea that every white guy is more powerful than every black guy is absurd. Cultural appropriation is not real. If it was, I couldn't wear pants. I mean, so just you go through all this stuff, sane immigration policy makes sense. The thing to remember is that a lot of what you hear, from the very extreme right, too, which is chapter 10, but especially from the people that are dominating most of the media most of the time, is wrong. Do your own thinking. Go to the library and buy my book.
What a novel idea. Think for yourself. And he's right. Buy his book, Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. Professor Wilfred Riley, thanks you for coming in.
Thank you.
Enjoyed the conversation. Good luck with the book.
Much.
Good luck with the project. And we'll have you back on the show many, many times.
Sounds good.
You guys have a great weekend. It's Valentine's Day. You're screwed if you haven't planned ahead. And you're not going to be Yeah, never mind. You can finish that sentence in your head. You can email me, Derek at dailycaller.com. Have a great weekend. See you back here on Monday.